It's the Avro Air edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Romans in Japan, superhuman mutants, killer grass, and the plot against the Avro Arrow. Let's begin episode 172.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher speaking. Ethan.
Yes.
Apparently in the United States there's this huge uproar going up over the last people you would ever think. People who are sitting there and they're worried about those who are suffering, those who are ill, suffering, prejudiced, all sorts of bad things. And these helpful people are trying to administer aid. They're trying to raise their spirits. They're trying to offer them. And it's nuns. Apparently, nuns in the United States are considered vilified because they're trying to help out people who are homosexual and that sort of thing, you know, who are trying to deal with AIDS. And the Catholic diocese in the United States, the Republican Party has come out and said these nuns are horrible. I mean, isn't it amazing how Americans are really so crazy?
Well, it's not just Americans, Don, as you may have heard. It turns out that the Vatican, the source of all wisdom in the universe, has revealed to us that the horror that is the ordination of women is as bad as child molestation, and henceforth will be punished exactly the same way the church deals with that child molestation. So they're going to cover it up and move the women to different parishes. No, actually, the Vatican...
Too early.
Yeah, the Vatican. The Vatican is suggesting that they adopt some new rules, and these rules will apply to women who have the audacity to try to become priests.
Actually, just to correct you a little bit, it's not so much the women themselves who, I mean, because they're not ordained anyhow, so it's right, not like right. They can really do too much to them. But the priests who dare to ordain these women as priests or the bishops
right.
or whoever.
It's, whoever is involved in the process, I suspect, will all get an equal share of finger wagging. Anyway, the church has decreed that this process of ordinating women is just as terrible as, you know, molesting children. So they will face the ultimate punishment, excommunication, which of course is the imaginary punishment, which only means anything if you've already drunk the Kool-Aid, and a defrocking.
Ouch, that's gotta hurt.
Well, not really, actually. It's a bit more tangible, but hardly seems like the appropriate punishment for something like rape.
Actually, it's... I was going to say the F word, but I won't. It's unusual that the term defrocking. Defrocking is technically where you're sort of denied to be a priest, mm-hmm. and you're not allowed to do any official services. But in my reading, apparently when you become a Catholic priest, you become one for life. Not even the Pope can take away that away. So if you are a defrocked priest and you give communion or something, it is still considered valid, though illicit, which strikes me as weird, but...
Well... It kind of makes sense when you look at the logic that the church is using right now. So if you might be saying to yourself, you know, isn't it a little, like, ludicrously insulting to treat these two situations as equal? But you may not realize just how horrified the Catholic Church is of girls. Recently, the Vatican remarked that the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is an organization that represents about 80% of the nuns in America, was promoting, quote, radical feminist theories, and was not supporting church teachings on male-only priesthood and homosexuality, which was what Don was talking about a little bit earlier. So, by the Catholic Church's standards, these women are as bad as, well, skeptics, really.
Well, you know, from the article that I was reading, they had said in this one line, quote, The new rules mean that priests can be defrocked or excommunicated for pedophilic offense, sexual abuse of mentally handicapped adults, and attempting to ordain women. And you kind of go, bad, bad, what?
Yeah.
There seems to be a huge disconnect between one and the other. But, you know, this is sort of the same thing with my feelings with regards to sort of gay marriage and all that sort of thing, right? I mean, it's great that we have equality, but at the same time, it's an institution that I don't really believe in. Marriage, I personally believe, is more of a economic contract. It's a form of slavery, sort of an enacted ritual, but still. And in the same way, you know, denying women to become priests, in an odd sort of way for me, sort of like saying, ooh, lucky them. They don't have to worry about trying to live up to these insane standards. Although, of course, as Catholics, they still have to live up to these insane standards. I was reading the other day about how the Vatican has hired a new public relations person who used to work for Fox Radio, which is one strike against him. But apparently he's also a member of Opus Dei. And he lives in a man-only house. I assume man-only, because boys probably have more issues than that than they need. But apparently, in order to keep themselves pure, the men leave the house so the women can come in and do up all the cleaning and the laundry and all that, which just struck me as so hilarious, right?
Yeah, I still recall hearing about Opus Dei. Didn't they write the Da Vinci Code or something like that?
They didn't write the Da Vinci Code, but they were the ones who were trying to keep the secret on Jesus' secret love child living in northern Scotland, or I guess southern Scotland, but in Scotland anyhow.
Okay, well, almost as bad.
Yes, but you know, it's funny how, you know, Vatican is in what city?
Well, Vatican City.
Well, okay, but that is in itself inside of another metropolis.
Rome.
And Rome has made the news yet again. It seems that rumors of alien visitation might be true. Or at least that's what you'd probably hear from the Discovery Channel or the History Channel or one of the other supposedly science networks that have gone to the woo. This week it was announced that some glass beads believed to be of Roman origin were found in a 5th century Japanese tomb. Now, for those poor in geography, Rome is about 6,000 miles from Japan. In ancient times, an almost insurmountable distance. Well, I guess not really, depending on how you look at it. If you figure the Roman Empire had expanded to the Persian Gulf at one point, and trade between China and Rome itself was actually quite common even by as early as the 1st century. The first diplomatic contact between Rome and the Han Dynasty is believed to have occurred about 166 CE. The distance for one individual person to go from Rome to Tokyo would be pretty hard to do in those type of days, but not for goods or this sort of knickknacks that would have gone. Mm-hmm. The object in question, something Rome apparently was quite famous for, are multi-layered glass beads about 5 millimeters in size, and they were buried in a Kofun burial site outside of Kyoto. Now, if it is true that it is true that Rome by this time, of course, in the 5th century, was quite in decline from what it was at its height. But the beads themselves were actually believed to be manufactured anywhere from the 1st to 4th century CE. So, again, it doesn't seem that weird that it got there. But at the same time, wow, isn't that kind of cool?
Well, the other thing that this could demonstrate is there was a really sophisticated trade network all through from Europe all the way to Asia. So, I mean, you don't even really have to have any Roman involvement other than the person selling the beads in, say, Rome, that could have been taken, you know, across the Mediterranean to, modern-day Jerusalem. It could have been traded there to someone who took it further east and traded. I mean, like, it's not all that extraordinary that you would find artifacts from different cultures. I mean, that's probably what made them worth money, because they were different and interesting looking.
No, exactly. I mean, the Silk Road was in action around this time.
Yep.
Again, The headline article, as we've mentioned so many times on this show, right? If you read just the headline, you kind of go, whoa, oh my, this is so... And then if you actually build into the meat of it, or if you actually do a little bit more research, it's like, oh, that's all, right?
Yeah.
Although it was quite... I didn't know the Romans did this. Apparently, they had this neat little technique where they take sort of a thin layer of glass, which was not easy to make in the olden days. Then they put little leaves of gold, and then they put another layer of glass, another layer of glass, and they kind of build up this sort of layering thing. If you see pictures of it, it looks kind of cool, although, to be fair, we've had the same thing in plastic for a long time, if you look at any sort of decally things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Romans, they're pretty cool.
They were.
But speaking of things that aren't cool...
Oh, actually, okay. I was going to go... for what was really cool. Did you know there are superhuman mutants living among us?
Well, that is pretty cool.
Yes. Take note, I'm taking liberties with the titles in these segments, so enjoy. Okay, before we tell you about the superhumans that are among us, let us start with a little bit of primer on color. And this is going to kind of give you a hint as to what their superpower might be. Every creature with eyes can see some form of color, although the vast majority only black, white, and various shades of gray. Others, called dichromatics, can see two colors. Most mammals are dichromatics, like your dog. Humans and a select number of other animals can see three colors and their blends. Bees actually can see ultraviolet, but they can't see red. I didn't know that. It's kind of weird. Most foraging insects, some birds and fish, can actually see four colors. And pigeons and lampreys are believed to maybe see up to five colors. Now, you may ask me, what are these mysterious other colors? Well, we can't see them, so we don't know. And until we have the I can be in your mind sort of thing, and even then, there's a whole debate about what really is a color and what color means. I'm going to avoid that debate for today's show. Now, you may say, of course, well, I can see more than three colors. But you would be wrong, and you'd be right. If you ever look at your color printer, you'll notice that it only has actually three colors, or what we are commonly known as primary colors. From these three, all other colors can be perceived or created. About a million or so, depending on who does the counting, and that's under ideal conditions. Normally, we only notice a fraction of these. These colors are perceived by cells called cones. Each cone is for one particular color. So your dog has two types of cones. We have three. Pigeons have five. Now, as I said, under optimal conditions, we can see millions or so of colors. But for some of us, we either lack a cone or that cone is deformed. When this happens, we say you are colorblind. Now, in theory, any one of the cones could be deficient. But in humans, it's mostly red or green cones that are defective, and rarely, if ever, the blue cone. Now, it's also known that colorblindness is actually a sex-related trait. Over 95% of those with colorblindness are men. See, it's like men are persecuted. It's not fair.
Yeah, it's true.
Now, sometimes these cones are missing, but most times they're actually mutated, so they don't quite perform the way they're supposed to. In a way, it's sort of like if you don't see red, but you can kind of see pink, right? So that if you crank up the red, it actually can be perceived by someone with these particular kind of cones. It sort of creates more of a semitone detector than a primary color detector. Although women are relatively immune to color blindness, they do carry the gene for these defective cones. Some researchers, as far back as the 1940s, theorized that some women may have the three normal cones as well as these mutant cones, making them tetrachromatic. Dr. Gabriel Jordan, reporting an interview in Discovery Magazine, said that she has not only discovered a number of women with these extra cones, but at least one of them actually has supervision. Vision. Okay. Research subject named CDA29, no, that's not her real name, passed a test created to distinguish whether this fourth cone was actually active. The test itself was actually relatively simple. The subjects were placed in a dark room, flashed three color circles. For people who are like you and me, the three colors would look identical, but for CDA29, they were not the same. And she said, hey, one of those isn't the same. And the researcher apparently literally jumped up and went, ooh, I found one. So there were 25 people tested, and only one of them actually showed to have this cone actually functional. But if you calculate that 12% of the female population are believed to have this extra cone. So the next time that you think you're having an argument with a woman, remember, she may literally be a mutant and see more than we can, guys. Now, of course, the same warning should be applied, but it... Oh, whoops. That's it.
All right, then. Well, that was an interesting ending. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. So stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
Warning, warning, killer grass. There is killer grass out there. Okay. It sounds like a bad anti-drug campaign. I came across a story that purported to tell the public about a mass killing related to killer grass. Now, before any of our reefer friends start writing in about the benefits of cannabis or your mom throws out your stash, the kind of grass in question is not the recreational type, but the moo kind, i.e. the prairie-type grass killed some grazing cattle or so the story goes. An added twist to the story, as if killer grass wasn't really enough of a story in itself, is the claim that the grass turned to homicide because it was genetically modified. The variant in question, Tilfton 85, was developed to be more nutritional and remain digestible longer than normal Bermuda grass, which it is a hybrid of. It was developed in 1983 and was used on the field in question for more than 15 years. It had apparently started to produce, quote, cyanide gas, which poisoned the cattle, killing about 15 or so of them. Within moments, the internet was awash with articles claiming that GM grass suddenly turned deadly, and that proved we should not play God and stop genetically modification because it would inevitably lead to monsters, and no amount of testing could prove otherwise. I mean, look, this grass was there for 15 years, and it suddenly turned mutant. On the surface, this may not actually be that unreasonable of an assumption. I've mentioned myself that although I like GMOs, I don't really trust corporations to self-regulate, and that it's in this sort of lack of proper oversight that something like killer grass could, in theory, happen. Then, of course, I put on my skeptical cap and looked at the whole thing again.
That's a good hat.
Yes. Now, the article quoted from a local CBS station and not from a more reputable source. Sorry, CBS. Next, it stated that the preliminary cause of death was cyanide gas. So it may not have actually been cyanide at all, although there's a good evidence that will support that in the end. It struck me as kind of weird that the grass was okay for over 30 years and that this was the first instance of it turning poisonous. Now, for those of you who think I've screwed up my dates, no. I say 30 years because the Tilford 85 has been growing since the 80s, although it's only been growing in this one particular field since the 90s, so there's actually been 30 years of it being out in the wild, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's also apparently a can't-have-babies hybrid.
They can't reproduce.
Yes, there's a special word for that that's escaping me at the moment.
Okay.
So it's not like even in nature it can interact with other creatures around it, but that's a side point. I did a little research and found out that this was not the first case of cyanide poisoning in grazing animal. In fact, it occurs regularly every 3 or 5 years if you look in the news articles. The other cases, though, did not involve Tilfton 85 or any kind of GM grass at all. The most consistent culprit was Johnson grass.
Bastards.
Yes. I always knew Johnson was up to it. Wasn't him
a shady character
in the library with a candlestick or something?
Mr. Johnson?
I don't know. I haven't played that game for years.
Me neither.
So I found out that cyanide is actually quite a common plant defense against predation, although usually only in quantities enough to be harmful to small insects and slugs. However, under times of stress, like a drought, which is currently sort of plaguing the prairies these days, cyanide production both increases, because again, it's a stress response, and it becomes more concentrated because there's literally less water in the plant, so it tends to congregate it. And of course, let's not forget, cows, and you may not know this, Ethan, cows eat a lot of grass, which would even magnify the dosage that would be involved.
I see.
So it seems that it was cyanide, although hydrogen cyanide, not cyanide gas.
Right.
That was a culprit. But, of course, this was just a natural defense that the plant has, and it does happen occasionally, not the result of some genetic horror story. Of course, it gets better. The original article, and the ones plastered on the internet, said that Tilston 85 was a genetically modified plant. And it is kind of. It's the old school GM where, you know, you take two plants, give them some drinks, have some nice, you know, berry, nice music in the background.
R&B music?
Yes. And let them, you know, cross-pollinate. It's referred to as F1 hybrids. So, you know, at least in the way that we perceive genetically modified organisms, it doesn't even qualify as a GMO. It's just your standard hybrid that's been doing for thousands, if not tens of thousands of years.
Right.
So, you know, essentially this whole story was completely debunked that mutant GM grass kills. But you still get headlines like, these are some of my favorites, genetically modified grass blamed for mass cattle deaths in Texas. 15-year-old field of GM Tilston 85 grass suddenly produces cyanide, kills cattle. And GM grass produces cyanide gas, kills herd of cattle. You know, you're going to hear a lot of people sort of bring this up as evidence in the future about stop playing with God. You know, don't play God with nature, essentially. Well, you know, like God, this story is just fiction.
Well, that's a good ending to it. I mean, GM foods, I mean, there's probably very few industries out there that will invoke such strong reaction from people. And GM foods, for whatever reason, is that field right now. And something like this, you know, grass sprouting cyanide gas, that's exactly the kind of thing that people who, you know, have an axe to grind on GM foods are going to latch onto. And, you know, you mentioned this story, but locally in the Vancouver area, there's been a lot of special interest groups going around and trying to get GM foods banned in local municipalities. I believe a couple weeks ago, such a group petitioned the Richmond board of directors or the local city council, basically, to ban GM foods. Now, ironically, they don't have the authority to do that. That's like a federally mandated thing. So what they did is they issued sort of like this kind of very vague statement of, we acknowledge that GM foods are bad and therefore we will not stand for it in our society, and, you know, very NIMBYism kind of thing, right? And this kind of thing gets thrown around. And the problem is that the average person out there is not a farmer. So they don't realize that, like you said, this particular form of grass is not even really GM food. It's a genetically modified product that we've been, this, the same style that we've been doing for the past 1,000 years. So,
well, you know, and actually, there's sort of two takes on this I think I can bring up. On the one hand, as I say, you know, I mean, it's not valid for us as good people who believe in science to say that there's no risk. But the way their approach is kind of saying is that, well, in theory, hydrogen and cyanide together produces a deadly gas that kills people. Therefore, we should ban all chemicals. It's like, no, wait a minute. You know, sure, when a company comes in and says, listen, we've got this genetically modified organism we'd like to create, there should be a certain process to make sure that it is literally safe. Mm-hmm. And actually, most of my issues that I have with genetically modified organisms is not so much the organisms themselves, but it revolves around things where, like, with the Roundup Ready canola and all that sort of thing, right, where, A, people who start buying it have to keep buying it because you come in this sort of chemical dependency on the secondary product that the company sells. So they almost kind of give away the seed, and then they force you to buy their particular herbicide or what have you that you have to get in order to make the seed worthwhile buying in the first place. So there's sort of that sort of chemical dependency that corporations will do. You also get the idea that, well, again, using canola, because that's one of the crops that was big in my mind, is, you know, we have genetically modified in one area, non-genetically modified in another, and because these are patented, copyrighted things now, which I have issues with in itself, that, you know, if you get, these are animals, they will spread to other parts of the field, and people can literally be sued for the wind because some seeds from that crop went over to my crop, and now I have genetically modified food on my, and I didn't want it in the first place.
Right.
The other area that it can come into is the idea of monoculture, right? I mean, one of the worries we have as a modern society in our efforts to produce more and more food is we've industrialized agriculture. So literally now with genetically modified plants, you can have every grain of wheat on the field identical to every other grain of wheat on the field. And in the one sense, that's good, very predictable, you know exactly how to treat it, but you get one virus, bacteria, bug, or whatever. If it attacks the one, you've lost everything. That's all gone. And
the Irish potato famine all over again.
Yeah, well, and magnified, because again, the wheat used in Canada is very similar to wheat in the States, same in Australia, same in Argentina. So it would be a global sort of potato famine.
And the other thing, too, is if you don't allow enough genetic diversity in our crops, sort of what you were talking about, you run the risk of losing the genetically pure version of it, right? So, for example, if all of the original banana, or like original quotation marks, I guess, were to go extinct, we would lose the original source of the banana. We would only have our fake version of the banana.
Well, actually, banana is such a great example because the banana has gone extinct.
You're kidding.
No, believe it or not.
No!
the kind of banana that your grandfather or grandmother, whomever, ate 100 years ago is literally a very different species than the one we have right now, because there was a particular disease that went and literally wiped it off the planet. The same thing now is currently happening to our current breed of banana. But fortunately, as you were hinting at, there are still banana plants that are in the forest that are not the commercial kind that we eat, mm-hmm. that they can go to. In fact, there's actually a huge movement for what they call heirloom varieties of tomatoes, of, you know, all sorts of plants, not so much, you know, to protect the genetic diversity, which I think is important, but a lot of people complain that when you do have industrialized food production, flavor and taste are not actually high on the list of priorities. It's transportability, how long can it last on the shelf, how long can it last in the truck, how quick does it take to grow. And so, again, I was listening to one show about tomatoes, and they had said, well, tomatoes, they look great, they last forever, and they taste like water, right? And that one of the big things that they were promoting was this whole idea of, you know, heirloom tomatoes, that apparently at one time there were like 1,000 different varieties of tomatoes in the United States. Now you're lucky to find 5.
Yeah. Right? Well, that would explain why I put ketchup on my tomatoes.
I was just gonna say that it's odd that the thing that tastes most like tomatoes is ketchup and not the actual tomato itself.
Yeah, that is kind of sad. Let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we will discuss the Canadian-centric conspiracy theory around the Avro Arrow. Stay tuned for that.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
In Canada, June is recognized as National Aboriginal History Month and culminates on June 21st, which is National Aboriginal Day. CITR is a proud supporter of National Aboriginal History Month and is pleased to bring you special programming as well as highlights of events taking place throughout the month of June.
On Friday, June 19th, there will be a special screening of the film What I Learned in Class Today from 1 to 3 in the Fraser River Room in the Irving K. Barber Learning Center. June 21st is National Aboriginal Day. Join us at the Musqueam Community Rec Center from 11 a.m. to noon, then from noon to 5 at Trout Lake for a full day of celebration and music. June 22nd, the Waywa Library at 1985 West Mall Street will be having a special open house and cook-off starting at 11 a.m. And on June 25th, listen to CITR from 3 to 5 for music and interviews celebrating National Aboriginal History Month. And don't forget to visit the special Aboriginal community displays on show at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center all through the month of June. All this and more brought to you by CITR and the National Aboriginal Unhistory Month. For more information, visit bcnationalaboriginalday.com.
This is Phil Plait of badastronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, have you ever heard of the Avro Arrow?
Well, there's a whole movie and everything with Dan Aykroyd. What could be more Canadian than the Avro Arrow than perhaps, I don't know, maple syrup?
And bacon?
Bacon Canadian?
Canadian bacon.
Well, I guess that has to be by definition.
Well, for those of you who don't know or are too young, the Avro Arrow was a fighter jet created by Avro Aircraft for the use of the Canadian Air Force. However, the plan never really took off because taking off planes. The Avro Arrow, more accurately called the CF-105 Arrow, and more accurately referred to as an interceptor aircraft, was designed specifically to prevent missiles from enemy aircraft striking Canadian targets. Now, this role is largely obsolete these days, as modern jets are already fast enough, and we already have weaponry like surface-to-air missiles to provide, you know, better defense. But back when the Arrow was first being proposed in the 1950s, well, we didn't really have those things, and this was a big idea, right?
Yes. Scary, too.
It was a scary idea. Not long after 1958, when the Arrow was in its sort of construction phases, they had the first test program. And it also included the Orenda Iroquois jet engines, which are sort of a separate story of their own, a fantastic technology, but anyway. The Arrow was looking really good. It was fast. It was unbelievably sleek. It looked like one of the most advanced fighter jets ever created. But it was abruptly and controversially halted and then canceled.
What? Why?
Well, that's a good question. So let's provide some context as to why this particular jet was so important in the first place. The Arrow was one of the fastest jets ever built. In fact, even by today's standards, the Arrow was a very, very fast jet. During the 1950s, it was achieving speeds of Mach 2, which for the time was, I think, the fastest jet in the world.
Close to it.
Close to it, if not very close. The aviation experts at the time were pretty amazed by the Arrow, and rightly so. And there was a lot of excitement around because it was, you know, a piece of Canadian engineering, and it was a source of pride. Everyone was really excited about it.
And actually, just to go on, because the Avro Arrow itself was just like the first generation. They had actually plans for two other next generations, and the Mach 3 version of it was actually supposed to go, Mach 3, which would have been, by and large, the fastest plane ever in existence.
Right.
And as you point out, there's the two stories here, right? There is the Arrow itself, the plane itself, which was revolutionary, but the engines were also quite incredible, again, for another show. But, I mean, this was like Canada's technology top shelf. Hey, we're number one.
Oh, yeah, this was really shiny. So why did Canada need such fast weaponry? Well, keep in mind, this was during the Cold War, and the USSR was right across North Pole from Canada.
I hear you can see it from Palin's house.
I think you can, actually. Now, in 1954, the Soviets unveiled their new long-range Tupolev bombers, which had a lot of Canadians worried. The Royal Canadian Air Force believed they needed 600 fast jets to defend the North from the Soviets. Now, the reason they are thinking this is because any nuclear strike from the Soviets, they assumed would fly over the Arctic Circle, across Canada, bomb Canada, and then bomb the U.S.
So, well, maybe not bomb Canada so much as bomb the United States. One of the things that always bugged me about...
Bomb Canada on the way to the U.S.
Yeah, well, one of the things that always bugged me about this sort of, well, let's stop the Russian nukes before they get to their targets is, well, that actually means you're stopping them over Canada. And these are still nuclear bombs. And even if the bomb part of it doesn't go off, Canada would be awash in nuclear waste material from all these unexploded bombs. And, well, again, not so good for Canada, but I guess, you know...
Well, I mean, I guess depending if you're stopping all-out nuclear war. But anyway, another topic for another show. Now, the Arrow had some cutting-edge design, notably its delta wings, which allowed for more room for fuel and weapons, and also allowed it to achieve speeds and altitude previously unmatched.
What's a delta wing?
Well, the Delta Wing is what the Arrow's wings look like. If you ever see a picture of the Arrow, it's kind of got these odd-shaped wings, and that's what they call the Delta Wings.
Essentially, it looks like a flying triangle.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. And the benefit of this is that the Arrow could fly a lot higher. And the assumption was that this altitude would give it kind of a dual purpose. Not only would it be able to catch enemy fighters, but would also be able to see enemy fighters before the enemy fighters could even know they're being watched.
Ooh, stealthy kind
of. Yeah. The downside was the Arrow was enormously expensive. The initial cost, which was greenlit by the St. Laurent Liberals, was $190 million for 29 Arrows. Now, of course, as Avro started to improve the design, the cost went up. By the time that Prime Minister Diefenbaker came into office, the Arrow was looking to cost about $12 million apiece. So if the government was going to purchase 600 Arrows, as the Air Force requested, the total price tag would have been around $7 billion and change. Now, the other problem was, as they're working on the Arrow, technology is advancing, and they kind of realized we could just buy American jets that were comparable to the Arrow and would cost about one-sixth as much.
You know, that just the Americans are just always trying to stifle our technological
raining
advantage.
On our parade
exactly.
Again. Yeah.
I mean,
so on February 20th, 1959, the Arrow was canceled. The reasons being that it was a recession, the cost of building the Arrow couldn't be justified without foreign interest, and the controversy, well, came to a head. It was, the program was scrapped. Nearly 30,000 employees of Avro were put out of work by the decision, and the plans and blueprints of the Arrow were destroyed.
Really?
They were destroyed. And that was the end of the story. Or was it? Well, there are some conspiracies, as one might suspect. So there's three main conspiracies that I know about, and maybe we can talk about a few of the other ones that are out there as well. The first main one was that Diefenbaker, the prime minister at the time, was in cahoots with the American military complex and canceled the Arrow because the jet threatened American dominance of jets or something. The other conspiracy is that American politicians put pressure on Diefenbaker to cancel the Arrow, and he caved in to their pressure. The other conspiracy is that Diefenbaker had a personal vendetta against the Arrow and those who made it, and canceled it out of spite. So, before we get into all this, Don, do you notice anything interesting about all these conspiracy theories?
Yes, I notice they're all absent aliens. That always strikes me as a key point.
It's actually a red flag.
To put it in the context of the day, communists.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, that there doesn't seem to be any. Oh, wait a minute. There is the D word that seems to be in all these.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of focus on Diefenbaker. Notice how he's either portrayed as a schemer, a pushover, or a really petty guy. We should also keep in mind that Diefenbaker was a rather unpopular prime minister. He had just defeated the Liberals in an election and was under a microscope from a skeptical public. Now, I want to be clear. I don't usually defend conservatives, but Diefenbaker was raked over the coals for this decision. And many people suggest, you know, modern historians suggest that Diefenbaker was the unlucky person to cancel the Arrow. And had the Liberals won, they would have been canceling the Arrow.
That's quite possible. I mean, a lot of these sort of decisions are multifaceted. But to be fair, I mean, you know, he was raked over the coals, but I mean, right now, Harper is in a lot of public disdain. But you would do so in favor of your financial backers. And I think maybe that's at the heart of part of this, is that this was sort of the beginning of what they call, you know, the military-industrial complex. So these moneyed interests became very, very important as society evolved. But back in the 50s or what have you, it was not the same sort of juggernaut that you would have, that actually democracy, as we kind of remember it to be, was quite alive. So it would have been not really in his interest to sort of publicly take crap for it while still being funded sort of by the corporate elite, because that equation, that's only really a modern development really in the last 20 or 30 years that has become that way. And I think if we look back on that, we say, oh, yes, of course, you know, Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all that must have given him money under the table or something like that in order for him to make these decisions. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got elected if he kept going with this or what have you. And that might be valid today, but I don't think it would be nearly as true back then, especially an American corporation like the aerospace industry. You might have got, you know, oil, lumber. I mean, there were a few industries that Canada would have been vulnerable to, but not this. This would be kind of a weird thing to have done.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, the conspiracies themselves, they're not like inherently impossible because they don't really involve aliens or Bigfoot or something. But as you say, they're not terribly likely, and we'll investigate that a bit more. So the first one, Diefenbaker being in cahoots with the American military. Now, part of this theory comes from the idea that after canceling the Arrow, Dief the Chief, allowed the Americans to build the Bomark and Sage, the semi-automatic ground environment installations in Canada. And this also, like, eventually led Canada to getting nuclear weapons, although we had nuclear weapons in the past, sort of. But it also led to things like NORAD and that sort of thing.
Yeah, like, Canada had a token amount of nuclear weapons on our territory, but it was only after Diefenbaker and some deliberations in the early 60s that we kind of became a nuclear proxy for the United States. And even then, it only lasted for about 20 years. But
yeah. So here's the thing. The idea of Diefenbaker and who's with the Americans is kind of silly. He was actually known as being somewhat anti-American. One of the things that he was really big on was shifting trade away from America back to Britain, which at the time was really weird. And although he did have a friendly relationship with American President Dwight Eisenhower, most of that comes from the fact that Eisenhower and Diefenbaker were both sort of like farmers, and they kind of had that kind of weird conservative bond. Other than that, they really didn't have much in common.
Well, and that became much more amplified when Kennedy took office. Diefenbaker thought he was a spoiled brat, and it was definitely not a happy
relationship. Well, in all fairness, Kennedy, like, always mispronounced Diefenbaker's name, which I can see being annoying.
Yes, and I'm sure it was by accident. Wink, wink.
Yeah. The theory also puts a lot of blame on Dief and ignores some kind of serious facts of the world. During this time, the superpowers were developing ICBMs, which are intercontinental ballistic missiles. Those make bombers obsolete because you can just fire one of these things from your territory and hit your target. And interceptors wouldn't be able to catch these things either. So an Arrow would be basically useless against an ICBM. So that's why NORAD became such a big deal, because NORAD could at least track these things and, I guess, like, evacuate a city or something. So these are all pretty reasonable things for Diefenbaker to consider and perhaps make the decision to not go ahead with the Arrow. Looking at the second conspiracy, that the Americans put pressure on Dief to cancel the Arrow, this one kind of assumes that he's sort of like a kind of a weak-willed, kind of cowardly guy.
Pushover.
Yeah. Now, the other thing about this is that the Americans were developing jets that were like the Arrow, interceptors. I mentioned the Lockheed U-2. Don brought up a couple other ones like the F-104 Starfighter and the F-86 Sabre.
Which would have been the, not so much necessarily the interceptor part of it, but would have been a valuable replacement for our existing fleet, right? Mm-hmm. So this is where you mentioned earlier, you know, there were cheaper alternatives. Well, these turned out to be the cheaper alternatives we chose.
Yeah, and like the idea being that like a company like Lockheed would put pressure on their American politicians to give them control of the industry.
Well, sorry, on that one point, that actually is quite a common thing.
Well, yeah.
If we were Guatemala, Costa Rica, Chile, all of them were toppled because Big Sugar,
Well, yeah, it is quite reasonable, right? That's why this conspiracy has lasting power. But this ignores the fact that Americans who were considering purchasing the Arrow for their own Air Force couldn't do a basic cost-benefit analysis that shows that they could build their own jets for less money. And that's not controversial. That's just fact. And this wasn't either unique to America. Both Britain and France were considering buying the Arrow, and they came to the conclusion independently that we can build our own planes at a cheaper price. So the Arrow, unfortunately, got priced out of the market. It was just too expensive, and you could build cheaper alternatives. Now, This all seems to imply something that I think is counterintuitive, that the Americans wanted Canada to be less militarily developed. Now, in actuality, America was putting a lot of pressure on Canada to beef up their military, and that's why they wanted to put in those military bases with the nukes, and they wanted to have American-controlled sensors in the Arctic to make sure if the Soviets did attack, they would know.
Well, and actually one of the other sort of confounding issues that come up here is that Diefenbaker largely lost power over the whole issue about supporting American nuclear policy or not. There was a huge divide in his cabinet between those who wanted to go along with the Americans and essentially nuclify Canada versus those who were against it. Diefenbaker tried to waffle in between because the Liberals beforehand, under Pearson, had said, sure, you know, we're on with the program, let's go with it. Diefenbaker didn't want to sort of be the same as the Liberals, so he was trying to waffle, but he was under a lot of pressure from the Americans to give in and say, yes, we support the nuclear policy, to the point where ambassadors were recalled from Washington. Again, Diefenbaker had planned to call for an election to run on American interference in Canadian politics. So, on the one hand, it's quite true to say that the Americans may have had fingers in the Canadian political sphere. I mean, again, at this particular time, the Americans were interfering with everyone's politics. But it seems almost unbelievable that Diefenbaker would have come on side of the Americans in this particular case, because they were really the ones causing all his problems. If anything, he would have been more likely to say, well, screw you, we're going to go with the arrow, because that's the best way we can kind of stick it to the Liberals, stick it to the Americans, and win an election.
Yeah, and that's actually more his personality, which leads us into the third conspiracy, that Diefenbaker had a personal vendetta against the arrow. And he was known to be a rather grumpy person and difficult to get along with. And there are reports that Diefenbaker had a lot of issues with Crawford Gordon, who was the head of AVRO. And Gordon was also, I think, heavily involved in the Liberal government of the previous government. So could this be true? And it's certainly possible that Dief didn't like the Avro, but to suggest that was the reason he canceled the Arrow also ignores some important facts. First, it was actually the Liberals who first considered canceling the Arrow, but they lost the election before they could follow that up with anything. And the cancellation wasn't like a big surprise. The Conservatives sent several warnings to AVRO that the program was going to get scrapped. Keep in mind that AVRO was delivering reports pretty frequently, and the cost is going up and up and up, and they're going, whoa, hold on a second here. So when the Arrow was canceled, it was actually AVRO who fired their workers on the same day. And then they turned around and blamed Diefenbaker for the firings. Ironically, they rehired about 2,500 employees to finish other projects, but it was AVRO who were the ones in the first place to fire the employees. Putting the blame on Dief isn't really accurate in this particular case, especially when we consider the cost overrun and the previous government's sort of misgivings about cancellation. Thoughts on that, Don?
Well, you know, again, corporations are all evil even back in the 50s, so that's my stock answer to everything.
I see.
But, yeah, no, actually, it was kind of weird, too, because they kind of fired everyone that was, they kind of fired everyone, and then they turned around and they rehired a number of them, not all of them, obviously, but right, a number of them, to work on the pet projects. But, you know, I mean, most of these guys, you know, ended up getting snapped up by NASA.
That's right.
Right? And, I mean, Canada at the time was developing its own space program, right, which I think we go into a little later. But I mean, you know, this was sort of a fatal blow for Canada. And Diefenbaker, if anything, was very much known as a nationalist. I mean, he was very proud to be Canadian. Mm-hmm. And to do something for a petty grievance that would have caused this kind of damage to the nation in general strikes me as something that he would have thought was repulsive and abhorrent.
Yeah, it's not really fitting with what we know about his politics or his character in this particular case.
And let's remember, too, because you mentioned that Diefenbaker comes up a number of times, and one of the things that we kind of forget now, because we've many generations away, but Diefenbaker was an oddball. He was like the first prime minister from Western Canada. He was the first prime minister who was not of English heritage, who was German ethnicity. And back then, Germans were considered to be a different race than the Brits were, right?
Diefenbaker had a lot of self I wouldn't say self-esteem issues, but he was very sensitive to the fact that his last name was German-sounding and that Canada had finished a war with Germany not too long ago.
Yep.
And a lot of people speculate that a lot of what he did was sort of bluster to draw attention away from his German heritage.
Well, it also shows that there was a significant, probably, number of people who thought Diefenbaker was really a Nazi spy who'd taken over Canada. You know, I mean, like, there's sort of... There was something that did separate him to make him more of an object of conspiracy theories of derision than might normally have been. It's sort of the same thing we're seeing with Barack Obama in the United States. I mean, any Democratic president in the United States right now would have a hell of a time. But the fact that he happens to be black with a really weird-sounding name... Sorry, I even think Barack Obama sounds kind of weird. But just adds fuel to those people who want to find conspiracy theories.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are some bonus conspiracies with the Arrow, because after it was canceled, all the plans and blueprints were destroyed.
Well, that strikes me as just plain weird. Why would they do that?
Well, that's a good question. Why would they do that? So the question is... if you're going to cancel the Arrow, fine, but why not, you know, keep some of those plans sitting around? Well, the most reasonable conclusion was that they were worried about espionage from the Soviets. This may seem extraordinary to us now, but given the historic context, the Cold War, the fear of spies, it did make a lot of sense.
I would also imagine part of it, too, is that these were sort of high-tech classified documents, and it may be, and I'm going to add my own conspiracy here to it.
Okay.
Maybe they weren't all destroyed, but they were all removed from public knowledge. Like I say, maybe spirited away to England, spirited away to the United States, NASA, or the military defense. So in Canada, there was no trace of them left, so that you don't have to worry about espionage, spying. But the actual technological advancements were still preserved, because that would seem to be shooting one's foot to win the race.
Or something like that, yeah. Well, the other thing is, I mean, the Arrows themselves were huge. Like, they were big planes. And you can't just, like, put them in a hangar. You have to put them in a secure location, under guard, same with the plans. It's expensive to keep these things under surveillance. So destroying them was probably economically a prudent idea.
Well, you would see, if nothing else, they would sort of recycle the parts. I mean, yeah. A lot of these were, you know, high-tech aluminum and that sort of thing. And
yeah.
Again, what are you going to... You just don't leave this stuff sort of lying around.
Exactly. Now, one of the other conspiracies is that one of the Arrows was kept hidden. And, in fact, there are rumors that an Arrow got away the day of the cancellation. Some people report hearing an Arrow with the Iroquois engine taking off.
How would you know that?
I think it made a very distinct sound.
Okay.
Yeah. others say that one night Avro, the building, was cordoned off, and several covered flatbed trucks were seen leaving the plant, which is not terribly surprising. I mean, it's a military plant. But one source of rumors says that you can look at photos of the destruction of the Arrows, and you can clearly see five Arrows with one partially disassembled. But then in later photos, one of the Arrows is missing, and it was never seen from again.
Well, I mean, sorry. They're disassembling the Arrows so as to recycle them or to do what they're going to do with them.
Right.
And one of them goes missing. Isn't that recycled? I mean, they disassemble them, and then, they're not going to, like, melt the aluminum on the tarmac. They're going to send it to a recycling plant or what have you, or at least a garbage disposal dump. So, I mean, I think it would be weird if they had the five there, and, like, 40 years later, their five are still there, right? Because they're recycling them, or they're dismantling. I mean, isn't the whole point of dismantling to take them away?
Well, maybe. Or maybe something sinister happened. Because in December of 2011, an ejection seat was discovered in the UK, and it was confirmed to belong to an Arrow. How did it get there? Well, there's speculation that Air Marshal W.A. Curtis spirited it away in an Arrow before it could be destroyed. Whether this is true or not remains to be seen. However, he did imply in an interview with the Toronto Star in 1968 that if he had stolen one, he would not admit to it, stating when asked, "I don't want to talk about that."
You know, actually, it's funny, though. There's another... I mean, there's... So the one explanation is one was spirited away. plausible. Although, of course, it's weird that the ejection seat would be there, because that would sort of imply that someone was flying the Arrow, used the ejection seat unsuccessfully. I guess it would landed into the water, because I think you would probably drown. But wouldn't that also mean that the Arrow itself would have crashed somewhere and that would have been noticed?
Not quite. The Arrow had two seats.
Oh.
Yes, it was
so it's like one of those James Bond movies where, you know, it's like, Bond, I'm going to kill you. And Bond reaches over and hits the ejection seat, then flies the plane to safety.
That was precisely why they had it.
Well, you know, actually, but there's another more simpler explanation. Now, of course, people brag and they say weird things. But I used to work with someone who apparently was part of the team that worked with the Afro Arrow, believe it or not. And he claims that he had a souvenir, that he had the altimeter or some small form of a sort of a keepsake of the event, right? Because, I mean, the people who were developing the Afro Arrow, I mean, anyone who develops a major project like this, it becomes part of you. It becomes, you know, part of your life. And if it's killed in a sort of unhappy way, which this seems to have been done, you'd want to take just a little memorabilia, something. And, I mean, it's conceivable that someone took the ejector seat because that's what they could fit in the back seat of their car.
Yeah.
You know, and through some weird events, it ends up in the... in England.
Yeah. Well, the other possibility is that when they were shopping the Avro around, they may have shipped parts of it to England to be inspected, and perhaps that's how the ejection seat got there. We may not know. I mean, the problem is there are people who have parts of the Arrow may have it illegally, so they may not, they're not entirely motivated to come forward and say, I have it or not. The other sort of bonus conspiracy to go along with this is that when the Arrow was canceled, a lot of the engineers who worked on it were immediately poached up by NASA. And this has led a lot of people to believe that the team of Avro scientists who were working on the Arrow were anticipating a Canadian space program, and they were also going to build a ship to go to the moon. Now, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that Avro was working on a spaceship. Unfortunately, the sort of origin of that rumor is probably attributed to a fictional movie about the Arrow produced by the CBC and starring Dan Aykroyd.
Yes, you know, this is right up there as far as plausibility goes, that the reason why the British and Americans started World War II, they had to have started World War II, was to gain the Nazi scientists, you know, so that they could go to the moon themselves, because Germany would have been developing its own space. I mean, they had the V1, V2s, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to start a war with them to get their scientists. It's like, what, that seems a bit of a, not a cost-benefit analysis
Seems a little strange, doesn't it?
It does. Hugely strange.
Well, that covers our Avro Arrow section of Radio Freethinker.
If you have your own conspiracy about the Avro Arrow, why don't you email us into us at info@radiofreethinker.com. We'd be interested to hear your take on the Avro Arrow, the conspiracy that caused it to be killed, and where is that missing plane?
Yes. It's good canned content.
Yes.
Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so we should go to our skeptical highlights. Don, do you have any?
I have two, but to be fair, I'm repeating from last year. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Walk for Peace in 1982. 35,000 people marched to Kitsilano to the West End. It had grown to 100,000 later on. The BC Humanists Association is planning to join the walk to raise the banner of humanist commitment to peace, respect, and civil society. The march itself is going to be at Sunset Beach, Saturday, June 30th at noon. Now, the BC Humanists also know that you don't want to walk on an empty stomach, so they're planning to meet up ahead of time at the Sunset Grill to have brunch. They're planning to meet about 10 a.m. The Sunset Grill is at U and York. They want you to please RSVP so that they can get a number of tables, and you need to do this by Wednesday, that's tomorrow, June 27th. Of course, the cost for the march is free. The cost for the dinner is, well, whatever you eat.
Mm-hmm. If you want, I mean, you maybe walked out by the time you finish the peace walk, but slut walk is the same day, and that's running at the art gallery. So
that's close by.
Yeah, it's close by. So maybe, you know, pace yourself, save your strength, bring a Gatorade or something.
Exactly.
My skeptical highlight is SciCon, the conference dedicated to science and skeptical inquiry. It's put on by Skeptical Inquirer magazine and CFI, and this conference takes place October 25th to the 28th in Nashville, Tennessee. And it includes speakers like P.Z. Myers, Eugenie Scott, the cast of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and a whole lot more. It sounds like a really great conference. I checked it out. I looked at the registration cost. It's actually quite reasonable, very low cost. So might be a good option if you're, you know, looking for a conference and you don't want to pay more than $1,000. It's quite reasonable. And you can find more information at